97.9 The Hill, WCHL, and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus, dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, UNC Journalism Professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, ambush marketing at the Olympics. Our guest, John Grady, who teaches sports law and stadium risk management at the University of South Carolina. So, John, as I understand it, ambush marketing is trying to get the benefits of being a sponsor without paying the cost of being a sponsor. Is that essentially correct?
That's correct. You basically always have an arms race off the field. And the battle is between those who have paid the official sponsorship rights and those brands that try to stay on the fringe, so to speak, and get the benefits of sponsorship, such as brand awareness, without paying those very expensive, exorbitant, some might say, sponsorship rights fees. What's changed, I think, is social media makes this ambush marketing phenomenon now much easier to accomplish than it was back in the days of on-site ambush at previous Olympics.
And is the reason that it makes it easier is because it's harder to monitor social media instances of ambush marketing?
Sure. If you think about London 2012, they had very heavy brand enforcement. They would call them brand police, and they would do a lot of on-site enforcement with billboards and different campaigns that were on the ground trying to reach the spectators who were in London for the games. With social media, you're trying to reach a much wider audience, and the potential for those messages to get through without being stopped is much greater. The other complicating factor is that you have athletes now that have endorsement deals with their own personal brands that may not be official sponsors, and so the athletes also are helping spread the message of the ambushers for them.
All right, so one thing I want to try to understand is if the IOC, the International Olympics Committee, finds an instance of someone who's doing ambush marketing. The IOC, as far as I know, doesn't have police powers. So how do they enforce these rules?
Well, it's a delicate negotiating game. There's various ways they can try to stop it with a cease and desist letter or something that's been used in the past called name and shame. So you can actually name the brands that you feel are infringing your rights and kind of shame them into compliance. But you're basically trying to get the cooperation of brands who feel they have a legitimate right to market their brands during the games without making Olympic references. So that's kind of where the gray areas of ambush marketing come in. And you've got brands that are fairly confident they're not violating any laws, for example, trademark infringement, and they want their campaigns featuring their athletes to continue.
All right. So I have worked with a number of different sports organizations down through the years, the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, the Olympics. I don't know of any group that is more stringent with trying to protect its brand than the Olympics. And let me give you an example. I took 30 students down to Rio to work for the Olympics committee. With the Olympic News Service. So we're officially a part of the Olympics, and yet our school, our university, is very limited in terms of what we can say about sending those kids down to Rio. We can't use the rings, you know, in publicity material. We have to be careful about how we use the word Olympics. It seems a little extreme.
It seems extreme, and it often provokes some media, you know, attention and some media criticism, but the idea is behind the trademark infringement, especially if a valuable global mark like Olympic rings, which at one point, and it still may be true, they were the most valuable Olympic trademark in the world and most recognizable. So when you think about the concept of protecting the rings, they don't have much choice to be the way they are. In other words, as stringent as they are, they've got a valuable mark and they sell those very lucrative sponsorship rights around the ability to use the Olympic rings exclusively. So when you start to weaken that enforcement and let other people use them for all kinds of purposes, it starts to minimize the value associated with them, and then the top sponsor brands begin to wonder what they're actually paying for. So it's a combination of aggressive policing, but also a little bit of financial motivation that says if we let these rings become more loosely used around the Olympic time, then their value and their exclusivity becomes devalued and diminished.
All right, so let me ask you about something that just happened, and it might sound a little like an extreme example at first, but I think perhaps it's not. A friend of mine, his name is not John Smith, but we're going to call him John Smith. He's already over in South Korea, and he sends on Facebook a photo of the mascot, the Olympic mascot. And John Smith can do that, but what if John Smith owned John Smith Apparel? He'd get in trouble for doing that, wouldn't he?
Sure, right. The minute you start to have a commercial motivation for posting that kind of image or that kind of a T-shirt, a piece of merchandise, you're going to run into the commercial regulations. The Olympics usually calls it commercial rights management. So the individual poster, John Smith, if he just wants to say, "Hey, look at the ring," "look at the rings," or "look at the mascot," just post it on his personal social media, that doesn't seem to bring up any issues. But the minute he has a corporation or he's trying to profit off of it, then that's going to raise some concerns. But the bigger ones that I can recall, for example, Beijing 2008, a lot of it was ticket resale websites. So you'd have BeijingTIX.com, Beijing 2008 TKTS, and those were shut down basically because they were trying to trade off the goodwill and value around the Olympic words and slogans.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle, and now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with John Grady of the University of South Carolina about ambush marketing at the Olympics. So, John, you mentioned this briefly, and I really want to return to the idea of athletes who have been sponsored by XYZ company for years, and yet during this certain window, they're not allowed to speak about XYZ company at all when they're affiliated with the Olympics because XYZ company is not an official sponsor of the Olympics. And I know some athletes have real problems with that.
Right. So what you have is Rule 40 comes into play, and Rule 40 is an Olympic bylaw that only applies to athletes. So the brands themselves cannot violate Rule 40, but athletes and other accredited personnel like coaches or trainers potentially could violate it, and the sanctions could be up to disqualification. A good example from Rio 2016 is Michael Phelps. He had a personal endorsement relationship with Under Armour. Under Armour wanted to capitalize on his accomplishment and success in his last Olympics. They ran this high-profile campaign and really cool video in March of last year. But the reason they were able to get around what is so-called the Rule 40 blackout period, which is that what you alluded to, that three-week blackout where athletes previously could not mention those personal brands if they were not also an official sponsor, is because the IOC and then therefore the national governing bodies like USOC relaxed Rule 40. And what that allowed was for generic non-Olympic themed advertising to run if it ran continuously for roughly a six-month period. So from March of last year through the Summer Games, a year ago, that would be considered non-Olympic advertising, and it would qualify for the Rule 40 waiver. But it raises, again, that balancing test that the IOC and USOC is always facing to give the athletes their personal commercial freedom to enter into sponsorship deals, but also respect the rights fees they've already sold in long-term deals with brands like Visa and Coca-Cola.
All right, so I can understand why the IOC would want to do this, but 6 months ahead of time, that seems fairly daunting to have I know these people make a lot of money to come up with these advertising campaigns, but to have one in place 6 months ahead of time seems a lot to ask.
Well, and the word daunting is probably a good, accurate description, because you're trying to design a campaign around a 17-year-old athlete who may or may not qualify. So you've got the famous ice skater who was, you know, predicted to be a star in Pyeongchang, and she didn't make the team. I can't think of Ashley. I can't think of her name off the top of my head. But anyways, you've got this whole campaign. So you have, I believe it's Bridgestone, who is her personal sponsor, and said, well, we still find a way that we can use her in our advertising campaign throughout the games, and she still has good commercial appeal and has a good story to tell, with, you know, around sportsmanship and perseverance. But again, you're, the intricacies of the waiver process and the time required to run a global marketing campaign really is only going to benefit athletes that are household names already. It isn't going to do the job that the IOC wanted, which was to give lower name or newer name athletes some exposure and some sponsorship opportunities.
All right. So Rule 40 essentially says, dictates what can be seen and what can be said during this blackout time. And, you know, the critics have said, just like you just mentioned, that for a Michael Phelps, that's not a big deal. For Sally Jones over here, brand new, right, not a household name, that makes a big difference.
It does. The idea is you're trying to give these lower name athletes in lesser known sports some visibility. And so that's where the motivation comes in relaxing Rule 40. But if in doing so, you're only benefiting and giving more exposure to Michael Phelps, who doesn't need it, well, then what was the purpose of relaxing the rule? So again, it shows the tension between trying to balance the athletes' rights and their need for sponsorship, especially to support them in winter sports, where the you know, cost of the equipment and everything is so much more, perhaps than the summer athletes. But again, it's trying to give them some visibility, but also recognize that you've already sold exclusive sponsorship rights. And by relaxing Rule 40, you're letting other brands, as one of the New York Times articles said, flood the field. So as more brands are allowed to come into the space, well, then consumers don't just see 12 exclusive brands. They maybe see 20 brands. And there becomes some confusion as to who is a sponsor and who isn't a sponsor.
All right. You mentioned Under Armour. And in another article, Under Armour was said to be the winner of the gold for ambush marketing in Rio. Other than the videos with Phelps, what did Under Armour do to win the gold?
They definitely won. And I think if you want to be more accurate, they won on social media. Their presence on site was not very much. It was some portable gyms that they had set up along the beaches in Rio with the Under Armour logo, which to most Brazilians might not be a recognizable logo, but to American fans, or maybe fans in the UK, that's a brand they can recognize. But they also had some workouts on the beach with their endorser athletes. They mostly won on social media. So every time Michael Phelps would race, a few minutes before and a few minutes after, they would have some Phelps-related post on Twitter or on Instagram, and they would use hashtags. And the hashtags are their marketing slogans, marketing campaigns. So something like Rule Yourself. So what they were doing is, without ever using Olympic words or the rings or the words, no Rio 2016, no Olympic, no victory, no gold, they were showing other words that became almost cues that you were referring to the Olympics. And again, Michael Phelps is, you know, at this point, almost assumed to be associated with the Olympics. So it's not a hard connection for consumers to make what they were talking about.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to our discussion on Sports Focus with John Grady of the University of South Carolina. We're talking about ambush marketing at the Olympics. John, when I was researching for this conversation with you, it occurred to me that you have two ends of the spectrum. And you tell me if I'm going down the right path here. You have the Olympics, which is, you know, what you say, what you show, how you communicate about yourself, even as an athlete, is tightly restricted, versus NASCAR, which it seems like if you ever bought the driver a burger, you can get a patch on his or her uniform or on the car. Do we see extremes like that in the advertising and marketing world?
I think you hit on something that's unique. The Olympic sponsorship model, which is called the TOP, T-O-P, the Olympic Partners, that was conceived, I think, back in the 80s. And what it did was it created an exclusive and elite handful, and the handful, I think, is up to 12 sponsors right now that are global, worldwide Olympic partners. So those are the ones that you think of almost automatically, Visa, Coca-Cola, Samsung, right? And the idea is by giving it only to this handful of brands, you would create an exclusive relationship, a partnership even, between the Olympic movement and those brands. And therefore, or by association, consumers would think favorably of your brands if they thought favorably of the Olympics.
And
where NASCAR has gone with the all-in approach. Every sponsor that has a check could be a good potential sponsor. But there's a little bit of a complicating factor. As the IOC, you know, wades through these various scandals like doping or now with USA Gymnastics, that perhaps there's not as a glowing reputation to be associated with. But yet these deals are for long-term, decades-long type relationships. So it's a little bit of a good sponsorship model that's having a little bit of a test or a challenge right now, if that's the best way to move forward.
And the smaller the club is, going back to the IOC model, the smaller the club is, the more valuable is being part of that club, being one of these recognized sponsors.
Which is why there could and should be legitimate pushback from official sponsors when you relax Rule 40. Anytime you let additional brands in, you're by, you know, association, you're letting other people have some association with the rings, the space that you thought you bought with 11 other people. Well, now a couple other brands now have just presumably walked in that space, and consumers now become confused. So it's a challenging commercial balance, but the research has consistently shown time and time again over several Olympics, consumers are not that clear on who the official sponsors are and are not. And the other part of that research typically shows they don't care. So the value of the official sponsorship may be something more long-term, but it's hard to quantify the exact metrics that they're getting in value currently with each game.
Despite these challenges and the inability by anyone, I think, to police social media, I can't see these major sponsors walking away because of this.
Right. The model is successful enough. For example, take NBC, which is not they're a TV rights partner. They're not a brand in a way, but they're going to get massive exposure, right? They're expected to have massive ratings, all this coverage, all this virtual reality and streaming rights. So the Olympics as a property is still a very lucrative and enticing proposal. They're not going to walk away. It's more the nuances and the logistics of how to give athletes some of the flexibility they need to recognize their personal sponsors. One area we've looked at recently is congratulatory messages. So can the brands congratulate athletes if they're not official sponsors? And in return, can the athletes thank their personal sponsors? So you mentioned that blackout period, which started, I believe, about a week ago, right? The day before, someone tweeted, expect to see a lot of athletes being very thankful today. Well, that's kind of a cynical way to say the blackout period starts tomorrow, and then athletes would be more restricted in who they can thank and how, especially if that sponsor is not also an official sponsor.
So, John, we have just about a minute left. How does the IOC deal with these two constituencies? You have the sponsors who paid a lot of money to be sponsors, and you have the athletes who, without their sponsors, might not even be at the Olympics.
Well, they seem to think they've found the right balance. With the relaxing of Rule 40, it wasn't changed for Pyeongchang. The next test, the true test, I think will be Tokyo 2020, when you've got a Summer Olympics that is twice as many athletes and twice as many sports, and the commercial opportunities around the Summer Olympics, there just seems to be a little bit more excitement and name recognition. So I think the true test of whether the balancing that they've struck is working and has worked will come 2 years down the road in Tokyo. Pyeongchang is just another case study in how Rule 40 is working, and they feel it's working right at this point.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, John Grady. Thanks also to engineer Gary Kirk, and as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.